Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take for immigrants to be granted legal asylum in the United States after suffering abuse at the hands of their own leaders? Around the world, many people dream of relocating to the U.S. to escape government persecution based on their political opinions, their race, or their religion. But the legal hurdles they must jump through to obtain asylum can, in fact, be a rude awakening, particularly for those who lack financial resources and language skills. Other asylum applicants find themselves at risk not from their governments, but from human trafficking perpetrators or even spouses who are legal U.S. residents. North Texas immigrants who find themselves in dire circumstances can turn to my guests and their colleagues for not only pro bono legal services and referrals, but a variety of social services as well. Bill Holston is executive director of the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. Chris Mansour is legal director for HRI's Asylum and Women and Children's Programs. Bill and Chris, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here, Chris.
Thanks for having us.
So we will get to some people's stories in short order, but we should start with the definition of immigrant asylum and what criteria applicants have to meet in order to be considered.
I'll let the lawyer answer.
So to get asylum in the United States, you must show that you are unable or unwilling to return to your home country because you are afraid that you will be persecuted on account of one of those reasons that you just gave, your political opinion, your religious beliefs, your race, or something called social group, which is sort of the catch-all where gender-related claims can go.
I was wondering about gender because it seems there are many parts of the world where that's a factor.
Right. And it's been the sort of the hardest area. There's not a specific area carved out for women who are discriminated because of being a woman. So whether that be honor killing or domestic violence, so they have to fit within this social group, which is much more difficult. They have to meet certain legal criteria, and the courts don't look too favorably on a lot of those claims.
Mm-hmm. Is that simply because if we were to codify that in the law and put gender in there specifically, we would just have a flood of people?
I think that's the worry, although my understanding is that Canada has a separate category for gender-based claims, and they have not had that floodgate of people coming here. I think the problem is that it's really hard for people to get here. And in a lot of those areas of the world where women are so subjugated, it's almost impossible for them to escape anyways.
Mm-hmm. And of course, some people do file their claims for asylum from a U.S. embassy or at a U.S. embassy in either the country of origin or somewhere else they've gone.
Not really. That's really what refugee status is. So, and the legal definition of a refugee and an asylum seeker is the same. But a refugee is someone who goes somewhere outside of their country, goes to a refugee camp or an embassy, and gets somehow granted that status. And then they come to the United States, and they have full legal status when they get here. An asylum seeker comes some other way, often on a visa, maybe a student visa or a visitor's visa, or they come through a smuggler and try to enter Texas, especially illegally, or they walk right up to Border Patrol. So, and then once they get here, they apply for asylum. So that's really the difference.
So Chris talked about the need to prove that they feel that they are in danger. What does it take? The burden of proof is on the applicant. Is that right?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Well, you have to show the most important factor is to tell their story in a credible way. And so once somebody applies for asylum, there's a two-step process, or there's two different ways they can apply for asylum. One is called an affirmative application, where they fill out a very, very detailed form called an I-589, and it's got a very, very detailed history of everything that happened to them. In some of our clients' cases, that can be decades of mistreatment by the government, and so they're talking about dates and times. And so one of the portions of that burden of proof is to tell that story in a credible way and consistently with the affirmative application they filled out. The other thing is that there is a requirement for them to bring, if possible, corroborative evidence, which is quite difficult because a lot of times our clients are people, they've escaped from some torture chamber or prison, and they aren't able to go back to their home. They're literally running for their lives. And so they may get here literally with the bag of clothes and no documents to back up that claim. Occasionally they do. They may have some medical records, photographs of injuries, party cards, maybe a newspaper clipping that shows that they were at a rally, that sort of thing. And also expert testimony we'll put on from people that can testify about country conditions.
That was what I was going to follow up with. It doesn't have to necessarily be specific to that individual if you can show that in the region of the country where you were living, there have been problems.
Well, you, I think in theory that's correct, but really it's whether or not they've suffered past persecution mm-hmm. or if it's likely that they're going to suffer persecution in the future. It has to be a direct threat to that individual, however, not just some generalized threat to that group of people.
So clearly people who have been through these experiences want to have the legal right to stay here. On the other hand, if they have been living in a country where you cannot trust the government, what does it take for somebody to sort of get up the courage to fill out these applications, tell their whole story, give every bit of information? Are people afraid to even apply?
Yes, that is something that we see. To obtain asylum in the United States, you have to apply within a year of entering the country. And there's a huge problem with people not meeting that deadline because they get here and they think of the United States as just being a place that protects human rights. Mm-hmm. They don't really know what the asylum process is or that they need to do something to get their status adjusted. Then once they find out about it, then yes, they need to be coaxed to tell their story and to tell their story in a way that's going to make sense to the asylum officer or the judge that's hearing it. So in many of the countries where our clients come from, for example, telling a story in chronological order is not how things are necessarily done. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that we and our pro bono lawyers do is try to teach them how to be able to explain their case in a way that will make sense to the U.S. legal system. So to not exaggerate, because in a lot of places, like you said, if they are used to not trusting the government, maybe they've always had to exaggerate to be able to get anything from their government. And we are very focused on making sure they stick to the facts and that they tell their story in as much detail as they can remember, which also can be difficult, especially based on how traumatized they are.
Mm-hmm. So you guys have an astonishing amount of pro bono work donated every year. And for people who haven't needed a lawyer in a while, a pro bono attorney is someone who's working without charge to the client.
That's right. And all of we don't charge for any of our legal services. Mm-hmm. So either from our pro bonos or from our lawyers that are on staff. We have about 200 volunteer attorneys that donate services, and it's about $2 million of legal services a year. Pro bono simply comes from the Latin phrase pro bono publico, which means for the public good. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to use Latin on the radio.
Now you've had your chance.
Yeah.
Are most of them immigration attorneys to begin with, or do they come from all sort of walks of the legal practice?
Most of them are actually not immigration attorneys. Mm-hmm. Most of them work at a lot of the big firms in town that are national firms, as well as small solo practitioners. Most of them do business litigation or transactional work. And we train them how to do this kind of work. I mean, the great thing about being a lawyer, I think, is that if you have a certain skill set, you can learn any sort of law within a pretty short amount of time. And so once they've learned what they need to prove and get to know the client, then it's usually not super difficult for most of them and very enjoyable from what they tell us.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, it makes them feel good about what they have studied.
Correct.
Above and beyond the regular work week.
Yeah, I think that it just is a great opportunity for them to be able to give back. A lot of our lawyers get more client contact and courtroom experience than they may be getting at the level that they're at their firm. And I think that just the feeling of accomplishment when you have a client tell you that you've changed their life is just great for them. And that's what keeps them coming back to us.
That's exactly right. And contrary to what some people might think, the fact is most lawyers went into the law because they wanted to help people and they really wanted to give something positive for the community. And this work in particular allows you to do that. And there's a lot of, if you're normal commercial practice, you're repossessing Caterpillar trucks or something. I mean, it's noble work and you can do it competently and ethically. But you don't change a life. But if you've represented a woman who's fleeing an abusive marriage or a pro-democracy activist who's obtains asylum, you've literally changed that person's life. And that's very gratifying. And lawyers keep coming back because it's such a satisfying experience. They want to do it again.
So you did this for years and years, Bill, and then you actually walked away from your practice.
That's right. I started doing asylum work in the 1980s during the Guatemalan and Salvadoran civil wars, and I was in a small law firm, and doing all sort of trial work. And actually, I met a Mennonite missionary here who was working with the Central American community. And I said, well, if you ever need help, let me know. And my first asylum case was a Guatemalan woman whose husband was a labor leader, had been assassinated by a death squad, and I helped her get asylum, and I was totally hooked. So that was 20 years ago, and my policy was, well, I'll finish a case, I'll do another one. And I did that for 20 years. And then this position came open to be the executive director, and I'm at the stage of my career when I was ready for a big change.
So it can't be hard in Texas to find attorneys who speak really good Spanish. I wonder if it's more challenging to find them speaking Farsi and Chinese and the variety of other languages that your clients need to communicate in.
That's definitely a challenge. One of the things that we try to do is have our clients be responsible for bringing their own translator. Mm-hmm. Part of our philosophy is that as much responsibility as we can give to the client, we do. So we require that they be on time for appointments. We require that they call if they're going to be late or miss an appointment. And we require them to try to find a translator. Partly because we think for their long-term success in the United States, it's going to be good for them to be able to take some initiative and take some ownership of their case. So usually they can find themselves a translator. They have communities of other people, either through their church or maybe where they live. When that fails, we look for them through the universities here. SMU has been a great source of student translators for us, but that definitely can be a challenge with some of the more rare languages that we're dealing with.
Is there a typical story of how most of your clients ended up specifically in North Texas?
Well, I'll tell you one story. I think that in Texas we have, for example, less clients from China and more clients from Africa, in part because Texas is on the smuggling route. So we have clients from Northeast Africa, from places like Eritrea, which is a horrible place that doesn't get on the news at all. And they typically flee their country. They flee to Sudan, of all places. They can't stay in Sudan. The Eritrean government will try to come and find them and take them back. And the Sudanese government, if they catch them, will send them back. But they do find smugglers there. And the typical story we hear is that the smuggler gives them fake papers and flies them, sometimes via Dubai or Russia or Cuba. They end up in South America. And then it's sort of like a planes, trains, and automobiles to get through Central America. In Mexico, they actually usually turn themselves in to Mexican immigration authorities and are held for about 30 days. And then they are given a piece of paper that gives them about 30 days to leave the country. And actually, with that piece of paper, they can travel freely throughout Mexico and can come to the border. And then they go to the border of the United States. And most of our clients walk right up to Border Patrol and turn themselves in and mm-hmm. say, I'm afraid to go back, or asylum, or human rights. They say something, and then they get interviewed by an officer who gives them what's called a credible fear interview. And if they pass that credible fear interview and they're not deemed a security risk, then they're released. So that's how a lot of people get to Texas. How they get to Dallas is there's a lot of immigrant communities here. And so they may have a slip of paper with a friend of a friend of a friend number on it, and they call that person. We've had clients tell us that the person was in Chicago, and they said, well, I can't come to South Texas and get you, but I have a friend in Dallas mm-hmm. who can. And so that's typically how they end up in Dallas area.
We're talking this hour about caring for abused immigrants and refugees in North Texas with Chris Mansour, who is legal director for the Human Rights Initiative's Asylum and Women and Children's Programs. Bill Halston is here as well. He is executive director of the Human Rights Initiative in North Texas. If you would like to join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're talking this hour about caring for the abused immigrants and refugees of North Texas with two representatives from the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. Bill Holston is executive director. Chris Mansour is legal director for the Asylum Program and the Women and Children's Program. If you'd like to be part of this program, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. How often do people walk into your offices knowing what you can do for them and what you cannot do for them?
I think it depends. We have a pretty rigorous phone screening process. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, hopefully someone's called us and then our receptionist has gone through with them sort of what the facts of their case are. So they're hopefully only coming to see us if there's something that we think we will be able to help them with. Having said that, I think that they do come in not really understanding the U.S. legal system and having a whole myriad of other problems, having housing problems, food problems. The asylum clients are not allowed to work during the process, and so that can make life really difficult for them. I don't know that they assume we're going to fix those problems, but we're their only sort of contact point, so they're going to tell us, you know, everything that they have going wrong in their lives and then see what we can do to help.
When you say they can't work, I know that that's a federal restriction, but sometimes these things drag on for months and months. How do people support themselves?
Well, that's a really good question. They really don't support themselves. They're really literally living on the kindness of strangers. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they may have a family member. Sometimes they're involved with they get in touch with the community through a church. You know, if you have an Egyptian Coptic Christian, they contact the Egyptian Coptic Church. Maybe somebody in that family will take them in. But their living situations are very precarious, and they're living there just as long as somebody will let them sleep on their couch. And we have clients quite often contact us and say, "Well, I got to move tomorrow. What should I do?" Mm-hmm. We help them with referrals to food pantries. You know, they're not entitled to any government benefits at all. So how they're able to live is, and it can take up to 18 months now for their case to go to trial. So it's that's the answer. It's just very, very difficult.
Well,
it's
a recipe for a huge amount of stress, particularly if they have arrived traumatized. Then they cannot sort of feel like they're getting themselves back on their own two feet. Talk a little bit about, you mentioned some of the referrals that you make, but your organization has partnerships sort of around North Texas, and how do those work?
We have a client services administrator who deals with all of our clients' non-legal needs. And she's not a social worker, but her job is to sort of connect with every resource in the community that we might need in order to fulfill the needs that our clients have. So we have partnerships with food banks. We have lots of partnerships with counselors. There's the Center for Survivors of Torture. There's VIP over at Parkland. So there are, because almost all of our clients need counseling of some mm-hmm. kind, and that really helps them a lot. We have found, you know, through the time that they're with us. In terms of housing, that can be a huge challenge for our clients who are survivors of domestic violence. There are shelters, although usually they need to be fleeing an immediate danger. So if it's dissipated a little bit, mm-hmm. then that makes it more difficult. So a lot of times she's just getting on the phone, calling churches, asking the client what connections they have. So really it's – and then once they get status, she helps them with – returning to school so that they can get licensed in whatever they were maybe doing in their home country, helps them find jobs so that they can just start to make some kind of a living for themselves. So she has a huge responsibility in a wide variety of things that she does.
What do we know about the long-term outcomes for people who are, in fact, accepted and receive asylum and are able to start working? How do they do?
Well, that's great. We've been around long enough. The agency's been around for 12 years now, and so now we've been around long enough to see how some of our clients have turned out. And actually, a lot of them are become very successful. We had a client who was a soccer coach in his home country, lost everything, and now he coaches soccer here. We have a client who was a journalist from Africa. He obtained asylum. He's actually one of our first clients. Now he's serving in the American military. We have a recent client who's just was able, through the assistance of volunteers. He was a doctor in an African country, and now he's able to practice medicine here. So we have anecdotal evidence, at least, that our clients – because the thing is, from the asylum program in particular, these are very – many times very educated people. People have been very successful. That's how they got in trouble to begin with, is that they were people of some prominence who became involved in a political movement. And so they're very motivated to succeed.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Terry in Flower Mound. Hi, Terry.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I work at Louisville High School. And we have the largest Chin refugee population in the state, and I believe in the country now. And it's a very interesting element to the problem. Is, you know, what about the kids who go to school? I would just encourage people to in the Louisville ISD to be aware that we have a large Chin population. They're refugees, and we really need more mentoring help. With these students, the Village Church has started a refugee ministry program that we're in the process of trying to hook up with, and so that's another element to this issue.
Thanks so much for your call.
We've had clients. We've had Chin clients. We've had Kachin clients. Lots of a lot of the Burmese have come in as refugees, but we have had asylum clients as well. And there's a large Chin and Kachin and Karen populations here in Dallas.
I think the caller also points out the importance of focusing on the children of these refugees and asylum seekers, because in terms of talking about long-term outcomes, one of the most gratifying things to see is how sort of acculturalized the children become, because, you know, once they're given these opportunities, their parents are usually pretty strict about making them do well in school, and they really take hold of that, has been my experience. But they do need help adjusting to life in America and the expectations that we have here.
So now, my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the families of someone who has come over individually, they're sort of a third-tier priority in terms of being granted asylum. How does that process work, and what does it take to bring over a spouse or children?
Within 2 years of them being granted asylum, they have to apply for that. It's called a relative petition, and we help our clients with that, and there's a certain amount of adjudication that goes out that the Department of Homeland Security does. And then once they approve it, then it gets sent to the embassy in the home country, and then they have their own sort of process that they need to go through to issue the visa. So it definitely it can be kind of a long process, complicated. It can be somewhat expensive. Certainly with children, you have to be able to prove, and marriages, you have to be able to prove the marriage, prove that you're actually the father or the mother of these children. And that can, again, be complicated, as Bill said before, if you don't have those documents, and if the family is in hiding or something over in the home country.
Yeah, I'd like to add, it's quite common that our asylum clients are men who had to flee and left their wife and children behind. And there's a good deal of guilt that's attached to that, but they had no choice in most cases. And one of the most gratifying things we get to do is within that 2 year period, help them bring their families over here and watch a family become reunited. It's a great thing to see.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Jane in Dallas. Hello, Jane.
Hi. I work with the parole division in the city in Dallas, and occasionally we come across somebody who has been through our criminal justice system and who has come out of prison and actually is an illegal immigrant of one sort or another. And with the specific immigrants that I'm thinking of are not necessarily from Central and South America. I'm actually specifically thinking of a place like Vietnam, where we may have somebody who may have gotten here either legally or illegally initially, gotten in trouble with the law here, and then comes out and is now here illegally and will not be sent back to their home country. Like I said, someplace like Vietnam where we have some sort of history. and will not be sent back, but also is here illegally and cannot get documentation here to get legal status. They kind of live in this limbo where they end up literally couch surfing from one abusive employer to the next abusive employer. They don't make a lot of money. They don't have any documentation. So it's kind of, they're kind of held almost against their will while trying to get legal. I think that makes sense.
Yeah. Did you want to follow that up with a question, Jane? Are you looking for where you might send these folks?
More for what can be done for people in this situation, and where can people in my position direct somebody like this? What can we do with them, and how? What? Where can we direct them once they're coming in? If they're coming in and reporting, and otherwise trying to be in good legal status, they just can't get any kind of documentation anywhere.
Okay, thanks so much for your call, Jane. And Bill and Chris, obviously there were a lot of generalizations in that question, but maybe you can speak to it in a general sense.
Well, I guess my first response is that doesn't really describe the people we help, because that's a very narrow group of people. Those are people who are persecuted because of one of those five grounds, or people that are domestic abuse victims, or people that are victims of crime. It's very so we're not a general immigration legal services group. There are organizations here that that do more general immigration services, and there, of course, is a private bar for people. I guess what she's describing are people without any resources.
And I think the thing that's hard is, again, not knowing the specifics of that situation, but for someone who's just here, there can sometimes be no option. I mean, the typical ways that people do general immigration in the United States is either through work, through some sort of business visa, or through a family visa where a family member sponsors them. So if you're here and you don't have one of those two options, then there aren't a lot of other options, even if you have been here for a long time and you're law-abiding and you want to get your status regular.
Is there an automatic strike against clients who, for whatever reason, their visa has run out or they are not here legally in the first place? Is the process closed to them of seeking asylum?
No, the process is not closed to them. But if they haven't applied for asylum within a year of entering the country, it is much more difficult. There are exceptions that can be made, but again, that just makes it much more difficult. I think that almost half of the cases that are referred from the affirmative asylum office, which Bill talked about earlier, to immigration court are because someone has missed that 1 year filing deadline.
What are the national quotas for percentage of asylum seekers as compared with general immigrants?
We don't really have quotas. So it's really more about what countries are they coming from, and then the asylum officers or the immigration judges are adjudicating each case based on the facts, not based on, oh, we've already had too many people from China or wherever. So now, having said that, they understand that there are differences in the countries. And so I think it's much more difficult to get asylum, for example, if you're from Mexico than if you're from Ethiopia or Zimbabwe.
Based on the history of government behavior?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Based on them knowing that that there's sort of persecution that goes on and on in those places, versus being suspicious that someone is claiming asylum to get an immigration benefit when they don't really have a case.
Mm-hmm. Well, so for instance, Chris mentioned earlier the country of Eritrea, which is it's a little country that broke off from Ethiopia. A foreign policy magazine called Eritrea an open-air prison. So when a judge adjudicates a case from Eritrea, they know this is one of the worst places on the planet. And so the chances are a person from that country who's claiming to be, for instance, a Pentecostal Christian is as a legitimate asylum case, really almost because of where they're from. Mm-hmm. Whereas someone could be from a minority group in Kenya, well, there's a mixed bag. It's possible to live safely in Kenya unless you're from some particular group that's being persecuted there.
When you take somebody to go before a judge, what is that process like? Does the judge have sort of the final say? Is there an appeals process?
There is an appeals process. The judges do have a lot of discretion. So the individual judge is looking to see that the person meets the legal standard and that they are credible. And then it's actually still a discretionary decision about whether or not they want to grant them asylum. If they lose, there's something called the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is in Virginia, that will hear an appeal of that person's case. And then after that, you could still appeal the case to the U.S. federal courts, to the Fifth Circuit, and to the Supreme Court, although that doesn't happen very often because they have more of a discretionary review and they can decide which cases to review and which cases not to review.
If for whatever reason someone is denied asylum, are they deported somewhere other than their country of origin?
Not usually. At the initial hearing with the judge says, what country would you like us to deport you to? And then usually the person says, not home. But unless they have a way to get admitted to another country, they're going to be deported to their home country.
How does the U.S. compare in terms of openness to cases like these with our neighbors, with places in Europe?
I would say that we're probably somewhere near the top or the top to middle. I have heard that places like Canada and Australia have more open laws. I think they allow you to work during the process. The United Kingdom is also welcoming towards asylum seekers. I think it's more difficult in other countries in Europe. Mm-hmm. They all have slightly different processes, and some of them, while they may welcome asylum seekers and refugees, they may not have the process to allow them to eventually get the equivalent of a green card or citizenship like we do in the United States.
Let's go back to the phones now. We may take this call before the break and then get the answer after the break. We have Jock on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jock.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Brief comment to the panels. I'm actually a refugee, and I have lived in Dallas for 7 years now. And I was in a refugee camp for like 9 years in Kenya. And I know how difficult it is once people get here and try to make life in the United States. But, you know, I have worked with refugee students because I'm from Sudan and mostly help them in schools and other things that pertain to life. And basically, you know, sometimes we have organizations that really don't know where people that can help the community are and where they can get those people. But, you know, DISD as like a program where they can get people from the community so that they can help the students.
Thank you so much for your call. I really appreciate it, Jock. Thank you. We will return to our conversation about caring for the abused immigrants and refugees of North Texas in a moment. My guests are Bill Holston and Chris Mansour, both with the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. If you want to join the conversation, our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Bill Holston, who is Executive Director of the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas, and Chris Mansour, who is Legal Director for HRI's Asylum and Women and Children's Programs. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. I guess pro or anti-immigration overall sentiment in this country sort of waxes and wanes. But I wonder if you have seen a difference over the past several years, given that a lot of people seem to be almost reflexively closing their minds to the idea that we ought to have more immigrants from anywhere for any reason.
I think that we do see that a little bit. I think the thing that's noticeable to us is that our clients are not really part of the immigration conversation. Mm-hmm. These are people who are very similar to the ancestors of many people that you know. In fact, that they're coming here escaping political or religious persecution, looking for freedom, so appreciative. And then once they get here, they want to make the best of their life. They're not committing crimes. They're not trying to live off of government assistance. That's not at all what their outlook is. They want to come and make a better life for themselves. And it's just something that we don't talk about when we talk in this very volatile conversation about immigration in general.
Mm-hmm. Do you walk into the courtroom with a particular judge and think this is going to go pretty well? And then are there other judges where you say this is going to be a tough one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What do you do about that?
Well, we try to know the judges really well and understand what they're looking for. For example, one judge has said, you know, I know that country conditions are very difficult in certain places, say Zimbabwe. I don't need you to send me reams of paper explaining that. I really want evidence specific to this client. Mm-hmm. So we try as best we can to have that client contact friends, families, past coworkers in the home country to get specific information. Other judges we know, you know, credibility or the technical legal arguments are going to be the most important thing. So we try to prepare as best that we can for the judge we face, like we would do if in any other practice of law, I would think.
Mm-hmm. And does the Attorney General's office have the power to step in even after a judge has granted asylum and say no?
No, not really. I think usually if a judge grants asylum, then the Immigration and Customs Enforcement is sort of our adversary in the courtroom. They have the power to appeal the case to the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is, I guess, overseen by the Attorney General. But it's very rare that the Attorney General gets involved in a case. That's only happened sort of in very unique circumstances, I think, where people are trying to change the law and get publicity for a certain kind of case. But it doesn't happen in the typical case.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Mark in Arlington. Hey, Mark.
Hi. I'm wondering if the law prohibiting asylum seekers from working risks creating a kind of exploitative labor environment in which they actually do find work under the table as day laborers and are paid poorly for it by people taking advantage of their desperation for income.
That definitely is something that could happen. We tell our clients not to work. The judges often tell them at their first initial hearing, you're not allowed to work, don't work. And then they often will ask them at their final hearing where they're going to get a decision, have you worked? And if the answer to that question is yes, then it could be a strike against them. However, the situation that's described is something that definitely, you know, could happen, and I know it has happened in some cases where they are just so desperate for money that they will enter a situation like this.
I think our experience is typically it does not. They just live barely until their case goes to trial.
Can you help me understand what the legal justification is if it is sometimes 18 months and if they are at least in process? What is the reason for not allowing them to work?
The history behind that is that there was a concern. It was maybe a decade ago that there were people who were saying they had an asylum claim only to get work authorization and then trying to draw that out. So the idea is to weed out those illegitimate claims by focusing only on people who truly have an asylum claim and not just people who want to work here.
I guess my comment on that would be then our government should decide which one they want to do. If they're going to take 18 months to go to trial, then they should permit the people to work. The alternative is to create a system where it doesn't take a year and a half, because the year and a half is not our delay. That's how long of a delay there are in the courts.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next up, we have Jay on the line in Dallas. Hey, Jay.
Hello. My case is actually it's about me, myself. I came to the United States about 10 years ago trying to flee. Fleeing from persecution, and but it wasn't the problems I've had were the fact that it wasn't a specifically political or religious persecution, and I've had many problems with attorneys declining to take my case because of that, because it wasn't specific. It was the reason I was being persecuted is my father actually was persecuted. Professionally, and I mean, he to the point where he has been kidnapped and beaten, and to where I had to walk with bodyguards, and there were people after I could see behind the school bus, the cars following us. I mean, it was very, very tense, and I came over here hoping that I would be able to get legal status. And I didn't have the money to afford the attorneys that would take the case, and the ones that looked at my case said, "Oh no, it's not political, it's not religious. So you should have gone to your local police," which we did. But unfortunately, in South America, local police is corrupt, and they were bought by the people that were persecuting us.
Well, let me have you stop there, Jay, and I appreciate your call. We don't want to ask Chris and Bill to give any kind of individual legal advice over the telephone, but there are I would imagine, a lot of people who don't fit into the services that you provide who still need help.
Yes, that's definitely true. There's a whole range of people that need help with their immigration cases, or because they've been a victim of domestic violence or violent crime. And we do, our agency, if we don't take a case, we do send a list of private attorneys and other agencies that we know handle similar cases that where people can turn.
We haven't talked a lot about the domestic violence arm of your practice. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works and the situations in which someone would come to you?
Sure. So one of the areas is called VAWA. That's based on the Violence Against Women Act. And what happened was that Congress recognized that a lot of mostly women who were married to men who had green cards or were U.S. citizens, and so were therefore eligible to get themselves legal through that marriage, were not becoming legal. And what happens is, in an abusive relationship, the man is often using that undocumented status as a power tool against the person that he's abusing. And I just met a woman this morning who told me she didn't call the police because every time she threatened to, her husband said to her, "If you do that, I'm going to have you deported and you'll never see your kids again." And that is a powerful thing to tell a mom, and it causes a lot of them to not turn to the police. So what happens is that through VAWA, they are allowed to separate from their husband and still get that status that they were entitled to through the marriage. So they need to prove that it was a good faith marriage and that there was abuse and that they've ended the marriage and are no longer with the person. So that's one area. The other area that we help people in is called the U visa, and that is when someone has been the victim of violent crime and helps the police or law enforcement go after the criminal. And again, in that instance, Congress recognized that immigrants are sort of in the shadows of the shadows. They are the hardest group to sort of get to talk to you, and law enforcement has told us that, you know, that's really, they want the immigrants who have been victims or witnesses to these crimes to come forward and help them catch the bad guy. So as sort of a reward or a carrot for that, there's something called the U visa that's awarded to these victims of violent crime. The last group of people that we help are children who come here, usually from Central America, and usually neither parent is in the picture or the parents have been abusive, and maybe a grandmother or someone has taken care of them in their home country, can't take care of them anymore, and there's a distant relative maybe in the United States who they come to live with. And then there's a special kind of visa that they're eligible for if we can prove that it's not safe for them to go back to their home country.
Mm-hmm. Do those children end up in the foster system typically?
Not usually. Usually there's a relative that they go with. And part of what we do is take them to family court and get that sort of legalized. Some of them are in foster care, or if they're caught as they come over the border, there's a special arm of the U.S. government that takes care of them and yes, places them with foster families.
So you guys have a lot of pro bono labor. There are volunteers even outside the legal practice, but you've still got to keep the lights on in the building. And I feel like I'm doing pledge here, but you've got to, you know, pay for paperclips and photocopies and all that. Where does that money come from?
Well, from listeners like you.
Don't give the phone number.
About 50 or 60%, between 50 and 60% of our budget comes from foundation dollars, and the rest are from individuals. And we have people that give as little as really is just like KERA. We have people that give $10 and people that are in a position to be generous and are. Mm-hmm. We get no government dollars or any sort of institutional dollars at all.
And the foundations that support you, are they typically interested particularly in immigrant rights?
I think so. And there's a broad range of some. I mean, we're very fortunate in Dallas to have a lot of great foundations that are very generous. Some are focused on family issues, and so our women's and children's program will get funded with those. There are some that are more oriented towards human rights. We get money from a United Nations grant because of that. And then sometimes they're focused on things like the social needs of our clients, particularly churches. We have some churches that have been generous with the fact that for our social services for our clients.
Mm-hmm. Is that the first place that you would recommend people go if they are hearing this discussion today and they think, well, I'd like to do something for people in this situation?
Well, they could contact our just send us an email to either myself or Chris or really any of the staff. We just have 9 staff, and we all do a little bit of everything. And we have a volunteer coordinator that will help people get plugged in. And the best way is a volunteer. People that they want to know more, we're happy to visit with people and talk to them about our program and if people want to give financially.
How do you both feel about the way that the asylum laws are set up in this country? Are they for the most part appropriate and effective?
I think that on the one hand, it's great that we have them. I think that the United States is looked at as sort of the bastion of human rights around the world, and so this is the way that we actually put it into practice. I think that there are a lot of problems in the system, though, that make it difficult for the typical asylum seeker, such as the things we've talked about, the 1-year filing deadline, and the fact that they're not allowed to work being two of the biggest issues that they face. So I think that there's always room for improvement. We have an advocacy arm where we try to educate people and push for some of those changes to be made. It's not perfect, but you know we're working on it, and we're doing the best that we can with what we have.
Mm-hmm. Anything you'd add to that?
Just one last thing, because, and frankly, I'm reluctant to talk much about it because I don't understand it enough. But that you have immigrants that are getting detained at the border and having credible fear interviews, and most of us in this industry don't really have any idea what's happening there. We don't know the statistics. We don't know who's not getting into this country, mm-hmm. and it's entirely possible that there are people that are in harm's way. They're not able to see a lawyer. And they're going back to those places, and nobody knows about it.
So
and that's very alarming to me.
There is no documentation by the Immigration Service?
Not that I know of. I mean, it's very murky. Even the statistics that we do have, we're not sure exactly where all of the numbers come from. But what Bill describes is very true, that we have this understanding that there are people who are turned around at the border, or that their initial interview is done in English when they may only speak a few words of English. So we see little bits of that, but we don't know what the full picture is.
So you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
How many people will you serve in a typical year?
I think about 250 to 300 is our typical when you include family members of the primary client mm-hmm. that we are helping.
And do most of them end up staying?
Yes. I mean, fortunately, our success rates are very high. In our Women and Children's program, they're almost 100%. And in our asylum program, they're in the 80 to 90% range. So, yeah, I mean, the great thing about the work that we do is that we are able to actually change these people's lives and give them a new start.
Thanks so much to both of you for talking about this. I really appreciate it.
It's a real pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Chris Monsoor is legal director for HRI's Asylum and Women and Children's Programs, and Bill Holston is executive director of the Human Rights Initiative of North Texas. You can learn more at hrionline.org. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download that free daily podcast at kera.org/think. The email address for comments, questions, and suggestions is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.